Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Healthspan Academy. I'm your host, Craig Shearhart, and I'm here with my co-host, Kyle Freiberger. And our very special guest today is Dr. Gwen Dutrzak, who is a registered psychologist. She received her PhD at Western University and currently works with children and adults on their mental well-being and health as a therapist. And she has some experience with psychiatric settings, community wellness, and some private practice. So we're excited to talk about some of these issues with Gwen today. Gwen, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, I think.
Yeah, let's hope so. Yeah, for sure. So I want to start with the most pressing topic. Obviously, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and there's the outside scope is like people's physical health. But the side effect for that for a lot of people, just because we've been locked indoors and separated from people, and we know how much socializing is positive for our well-being. And I'm sure we all know people that are dealing with pretty significant mental health issues right now. And there's probably a ton that we don't know about. So I want to start with how that's changed what you've seen in your practice and how that changes your practice itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really such an important topic. And I think you're right. We're all kind of aware of it. Maybe some of us in more of an abstract sense, and maybe other people are really dealing with it specifically. It's been interesting because like it's been a year and a half now, right? And I think at first my practice was full. So the people I was seeing, I had been seeing for a while. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to see how they were all coping relatively well. And I think that might have had to do with the fact that they had already kind of worked on some skills to really support their own mental health, and they knew kind of what they needed to do. And so that's mostly what I saw at first. And I was hearing things about other stuff going on and people struggling, right? Maybe more of my personal life, right? But I think you're right. Like over time, I have seen, and researchers have even now documented, you know, how much of a mental health crisis this is turning into, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think the stuff I've seen in my clinical practice is a lot to do, like when we're talking about adults anyways, is people have, like you said, they've lost their social contacts and also their routines. Mm-hmm. And those are kind of like one and the same, right? So I think some of us think of routine as like getting up, making your bed. When do you go to bed? When do you eat? But like a big part of our routine as humans that are actually our mind or our brain is registering is when we interact with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that our brain is registering, and we've just maybe taken that for granted. But then coming through this pandemic time and not having those face-to-face contacts with people, our mind is just not getting what it needs, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And some of those hormones that are kind of created through face-to-face interactions, they're not happening, right? So I'm starting to see people where they just feel really unmotivated and they just feel really flat. And they're even observing, like, normally I would be really excited about this, but I feel kind of blah.
Mm-hmm.
Or normally I'd be really stressed about this, but I feel kind of blah.
Yeah.
And so I think, like our brain's just not getting the usual inputs, right? And so social is a big one.
Yeah.
But also, I think getting outside has been a big one. Maybe less so over the summer. I think a lot of people have found ways to get outside, but over the winter, that was huge. Like a lot of people weren't getting outside regularly. They didn't have to go to work. Like a lot of people were working from home, right?
Yeah.
I read a study where they found that actually the mental health of healthcare workers was not adversely affected compared to just regular people.
Wow.
Because probably they had to leave their house and they had a sense of purpose and they had a routine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess you're aware of
that. People to work from home were struggling a lot more.
Yeah. It's just, it's interesting because there's almost like no separation now. Like you used to be, you'd go on your phone when you're away from people, and now you're on your phone to talk to people. You're on your screens watching Netflix. And it's like, can your brain even differentiate what's supposed to be entertainment? What's supposed to be social? Yeah. So,
and even like you're not moving around in space. Like I've wondered about this too, like just being more, I've been more forgetful this year, even just myself.
Yeah.
And I think it's because, like I'm functioning in the same physical space almost all the time.
Yeah.
For all of my tasks. And I think, you know, your brain is set up to do certain tasks in certain places, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So I think,
and it's really messed with a lot of people's timelines. Like I can't remember when events happened throughout the pandemic like I used to. It's just because everything kind of blends together. And I guess like our memories are, they're so based on like these big events, right? And that kind of has their perception of time. And it's definitely messed with me. One of the things we talked about was getting outside. And that reminds me, because we often bump into each other in a dog park. And I did a bunch of research just to kind of give some tips for my own clientele, helping with their own mental resilience throughout this stuff. And I bumped it because I'm a dog owner. I'm obviously biased, but there's some really cool research. And I want to get your perspective on this stuff, because it's not just therapy dogs that help us with our mental well-being. There's even domestic dogs that have helped in older populations with their cognition, with their mental well-being. Talk a little bit about that, what you've seen as a dog owner and what your thoughts are, and why dogs can be so efficient for helping us with that mental health.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, because I think if you really start to think about it, they help in almost every area that we know is important for mental health, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I got my dog right as the pandemic was starting. Mm-hmm. So noticed that. Like, so one thing I think is really important is it gives you a sense of purpose and routine every day. You've got to get up, you've got to take them out, you've got to feed them. You know, you've got this being that you're connected with that you have to take care of, right? So that's a big part of it. And I think I read something a while back about some other culture where they don't have antidepressants, but they give someone a cow to take care of. And that brings them out of a depression.
Wow.
So I think a dog could be similar, right? Like, all of a sudden you've got this thing that's depending on you, right? You have a purpose.
Yeah.
So I think that's huge. But then I think getting outside is
for sure.
We know that being outside and movement are really important for mental health. I have met neighbors. Like, I've lived in my house here for 8 years, and this year I met neighbors I've never met before. So every day you go out and you're chatting with people, and I think it kind of breaks a barrier, like, socially, because you can just chat about your dog.
Yeah, right? That's true.
Like, I know all the dogs' names, and I don't even know half my neighbors.
So true.
Names.
Yeah.
I just know that's Mocha's owner or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
There goes Oakley again. Yeah,
and what's his name? Yeah. That would happen to remember anyone's name.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, and I think that's the other piece, is that that's one of the only outlets we've really had this whole time, and getting a bit of face to face. So there's that benefit, and I think, like. And it's really interesting, because I get almost as amped talking to people at a dog park that I used to, like, going to parties, you know, and like university and stuff, because that's, like, literally the only equivalent right now. It's really interesting. So yeah, I appreciate you chiming in on that. I want to talk a little bit about, so in this pandemic, you said your patients have dealt pretty well, and the practitioners have dealt pretty well. Now that this has become, and even just leading up to this, there's the stigma attached to mental health has kind of been defaced a little bit, and it's more wide in the open. And I think people are a little bit more educated now, and it's become more of an okay thing to talk about. What are some of the habits that you wish more people would adopt when it comes to their own kind of mental care routine?
I mean, I think lately, like this year especially, we've just been talking about how can you, like, be more human. Mm-hmm. So the idea of, like, we're human beings, we're this species called humans. And if you think about it almost from, like, an evolutionary standpoint, right? Like, what did we evolve to do? And maybe just doing more of those things. So kind of along the lines of the dog conversation, like, how can you find a way to be up when the sun is up? You know, and get outside sometime before lunch, you know, and move around, interact with somebody, you know, that's about, you know, and regulating your sleep cycle. Like, I think that's something that's really come to the fore over the pandemic, that so many people's sleep has become dysregulated, and they've recognized how big of an effect that has on their mood. And sleep and mood, there's so much research that supports that connection. And it's a bit of a vicious circle, right? But certainly if you can find a way to regulate your sleep by having something to get up in the morning to do. When I used to work in an insomnia clinic, that was the number one thing that we would say to people, is find a way to get up every morning, you know, sometime before, say, 9 o'clock, or maybe if you're a teenager, 10, know? So that's a huge one.
And you kind of have to plan that the night before, because you can't really expect to wake up in the morning and go, oh, you know, I know what to do now. Like, you know, that's the most foggy time of our day typically. But if you have that reason to get up, and then expanding on that, like, personally, you know, finding that community that helps you as well, keep you motivated. So that's where the online thing, I think, can really still help us. There's like Slack groups and there's accountability programs and just other people, other like-minded people that are in the same positions, right? So, you know, just kind of sharing with them, getting, helping them get motivated, get you motivated. But the other thing you were talking about was finding meaning. And, you know, when you'd mentioned that, it just thought back to Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Mm-hmm. You know, he talked about just finding meaning in every moment as opposed to like meaning over life. So does that, is that something that you kind of work with? You kind of touched upon like finding, you know, daily meaning. Is that something you kind of work with your clients on?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we would be working on that would fit with that would be kind of like mindfulness or curiosity. So kind of the idea of like, I wonder what will happen today, or right, like, I wonder about this person that I just met, or, mm-hmm, and having that attitude of curiosity and letting your day unfold kind of thing. And that idea that it's almost the opposite of what you think about when you think about having meaning or a sense of purpose, because you're not really striving for anything in particular. You're not trying to accomplish anything, or, but you're just sort of saying, well, here I am and I'm this human. I wonder what's going to happen to me today, you know?
Kind of accepting, so, and like,
yeah, an attitude of acceptance.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And then, and it's like that, you know, we're typically, our survival, you know, instinct is like negative and comfort, right? Whereas when we learn to accept, it's more of that openness and willingness to allow things to happen the way that they're happening, right? We can't, yeah, focus on things we can't change.
Exactly. And I think what's helpful for people is to find some kind of mindfulness practice. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be some kind of formal sitting cross-legged thing, but it could be just, I'm going to go for a walk with no podcast in my ears, or,
I love,
you know,
that.
I'm just going to go and see what happens, or I'm, mm-hmm, going to eat my meal and it's going to take me 20 or 30 minutes and I'm not going to sit there scrolling through my phone. Right.
Yeah.
So just really being mindful of that.
Some space where it just takes your mind off of, mm-hmm, your daily, you know, your daily thoughts, your daily routines, just allows your brain to relax. And
yeah. And your brain remembers what it feels like to like be in the moment. Like, our culture is structured in a way that we're always taken out of the moment, right? Mm-hmm. So it's helpful to just be like in your physical self and notice your surroundings and things like that, noticing your breath.
Mm-hmm. And what about helping people or patients or clients, or like helping people to communicate with themselves, to themselves? Because personally, this was probably a revolutionary moment in my life when I was basically, I just, you know, years ago, and still, like, I'm still always trying to figure out how to communicate with myself, like my feelings, my thoughts, my actions. But that was, that had me in a really stuck spot years ago, where I was just like, I don't get why this is happening, right? I don't get this. So do you work a lot with patients in helping them to communicate, like, just to themselves before they can even, because how do you communicate to somebody else your thoughts and feelings if you don't even know what you're feeling?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly it. Oh yeah, that's just huge. Like, I talk about that with so many different clients for different reasons, right? You know, this sort of thing about being so focused on what's going on around you and what's expected of you and what you should do. Mm-hmm. And maybe you just never developed the ability to notice what was going on with you, right? Like, I can say personally for me, I grew up in a busy household, lots of kids. My mom was like always coordinating the neighbors coming over, and it was just really busy. Mm-hmm. And so I think it wasn't until it was like my 20s that I really started to listen to myself. Right. Mm-hmm. And because I was a clinical psychology student, I did it on a couch 4 days a week, talking to an analyst, right?
Yeah.
Which is a very hardcore version of what you need to do. Right. But honestly, just listening to myself 4 hours a week, it was very, like, at first really hard, but then really helpful, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's other ways to do it too, right? To start listening to yourself. I think talking to a therapist is a good one, because it does force you to focus on yourself for an hour or so every week. Mm-hmm. For some people, it could be journaling, like writing something down every day about what's on your mind is a really helpful practice. And then another way is just kind of like the mindfulness type of thing that we talked about. Like, with some of my clients, we work on really basic things, like, let's spend 5 minutes or 10 minutes doing a body scan and noticing, what are the sensations in your body? because we know like physical sensations are the sort of foundation of our emotions and our thoughts, right?
Absolutely.
So going really back to basics about what you might have noticed when you were like a toddler, but maybe for whatever reason that didn't quite develop, right?
Yeah, that's pretty wild. Yeah, and then you were, I was trying to lost my train of thought there. But so another mechanism, I guess, that I was introduced with through my therapist was CBT training or CB training, I guess. And just like, you know, specifically coming up with like alternative thoughts or just, you know, exercising, right? Like training our brain, you know, I feel like a message that's missed a lot is that, you know, we need to train our brain because it's just default mechanism that doesn't care about our feelings. It doesn't care about, it just wants us to survive. And it's a very negative thing because it just cares like, hey, survive, seek comfort. Don't, you know, don't push yourself and be uncomfortable. So do you work with your patients and use CBT training?
Sure. Yeah. That's definitely, it's definitely one of the things that I do. I mean, I guess it depends on who the person is and what they're coming to me with, because I've got lots of different kind of tools and tricks that we can apply. But yeah, I mean, one thing is like identifying what are some of the thoughts that are coming up for you in these emotionally charged situations and just getting people to start noticing, right? Mm-hmm. So you're having, say, every time you have a work meeting, you find, you know, your face is flushing and you're sort of starting to shake and you're getting really anxious. Maybe start noticing what are some of the thoughts that are happening then, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe even in anticipation of the work meeting, that would even be more helpful. Like write down some things that are coming to mind, right? And then after the fact, we can go through those thoughts when we're maybe in more of a calm state and think about like, are those thoughts helpful? Are they realistic? And then maybe trying to come up with versions of those thoughts that are more helpful, right?
I guess just how you communicate to yourself again, right? Mm-hmm. It's so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love that because when I stumbled upon some of the literature for habits and mental health, that was a big thing was journaling. And I think that's probably part of it, right? It's just a way of expressing your thoughts. And there's something like therapeutic about just jotting things down. It's like your thoughts just get jumbled. When you see them, you start to notice patterns and stuff like that. So I love that. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about self-esteem and its relationship to mental health. Because I know in my own experience, my experience with kind of dark depression, I describe to people as just total absence of passion. And I think when you don't have passion, you have no means to build self-esteem. So how important is those and how do you start to rewire that for people? And there's so many variables. So where do you begin with help addressing someone's passion and self-esteem and trying to get them to improve their mental health?
So you mean like if you're starting from that kind of a place where you just feel kind of lost and
if they're just like, they're just no, obviously just don't have a shred of self-esteem and it's just like, it's a spiral, right? All your answers, all your just lead to you darker down that, deeper down that path. So how do you start to break out of that cycle? Is there a template? Yeah. Is it just verbalizing it? Where do you start with that?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, there can be a lot of different, you know, reasons that someone's stuck there. And there can be a lot of different factors that might be maintaining it. So it probably is pretty individual. So I would definitely, you know, that's one thing as a psychologist that we do. We do a pretty thorough assessment when we first meet with somebody and try to understand all the different, like maybe there's childhood factors, maybe there's more short-term, like things that have been happening recently. And then there's also the maintaining factors, like what's happening every day for you right now. And those are usually where we focus right away. It's like, what's currently happening for you? And, you know, how can we shift that? But I would also say that a big thing that kind of is helpful for people is just being able to say, this is what's happening with me. I feel a real lack of passion. I feel really stuck. I feel like life is pointless for me. I feel like I don't have any, I'm not benefiting anyone or whatever it is that you're feeling, to kind of like unload that onto another human is really therapeutic, because I think that there's a lot of like shame and embarrassment that can go along with that. And to be able to say that to another person and for them to be able to respond in a compassionate way, to be like, well, yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense that you're feeling like this. It's really understandable because of these circumstances or because of your temperament or because of you know, like kind of putting it together in a really coherent story that isn't like blaming. It's not critical. It's just, it's a story and we understand it, right? Mm-hmm. And we understand it together.
Yeah.
So I think making sure that if there is a layer of shame or embarrassment, or, you know, if someone's feeling like somehow there's something wrong with me, that this has happened to me, that we clear that out of the room first. Right. And then that usually leads us to, okay, well, what can we do? What can we shift? And if somebody's really low, usually we need to bring in some kind of social supports or get a family member, a friend, or some outside source to kind of get things moving with them. But that really, it really depends on,
happening. Yeah. So I think it, like, just sort of paraphrase that, I guess you're more or less, and I know everything, all my brain just always goes back to coaching. You're basically meeting them where they're at, right?
Exactly.
And that, and being able to express empathy and get them to recognize that it's not shameful, like, and just verbalizing it, and just, and you just kind of being there as a support system is kind of that first step, and and admitting it. So, I love that. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about cognition versus mental health, because one of the things I found was that a lot of times, like, a supplement that they found has been correlated to mental health also seems to improve cognition. Some of the therapy involved, like the dogs, even improve cognition and improve mental health. Those are kind of paired together. And I haven't really gone too deep into the research and how they're paired or why that is. Have you noticed that correlation, and how do you, can you comment on that relationship?
Yeah. What do you mean by cognition?
Like, what I mean, like, you're just your mental function, right? Like your ability to problem solve and like memory and like how well your brain functions versus how well you feel, I think is, how do you find those are related?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
in so many ways. Like,
yeah.
So part of my practice is doing comprehensive assessments, and that a big part of that is a cognitive battery, right? So looking at IQ and how people process information, and you can always tie that to how they're functioning emotionally or socially, right?
That's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. So there's like a million examples of how that's tied together, right?
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to start exactly. I mean, one simple one in adults you can think about is people that are stressed or anxious are not really able to absorb new information, right? So there's a lot of research that shows that when you're feeling anxious and stressed, you've got that tunnel vision, right? And so you're not in a good state to notice things. So that can promote, you know, just not really taking in the situation, not being able to function well, right?
Right.
Not being able to learn.
For sure.
And then also depression can really affect memory. So if you're feeling really low, you're going to have a hard time with word finding. You're going to have a hard time remembering how to do things. And, you know, that can also be a bit of a vicious cycle. I've seen that in clients where because they're really anxious or depressed, they're not functioning that well. And that can feed into their story about themselves being ineffective. And it becomes a bit of a vicious circle. Yeah.
And it all can, I assume, can relates back to your physical. If your mental health isn't there, it's just a snowball effect. And we know that when we're more physically active, our cognition is better. So
I'm sure
there's multiple layers to it. I wanted to hear your comment. I think I'm with you. I like that.
For sure. Yeah.
That's the other analogy coming from a pilot here is, you know, we have to put our own oxygen masks on first, right? Like, you know, so often I find just through friends and family and trying to be a better person myself, like relating back to what you're talking about, you know, about having somebody just to listen, I have found the profound ways to be able to help somebody that I figured out wasn't through all my knowledge and all my value and all the information and all the experiences and all this wisdom. It was actually just to shut up and listen. And just listen with empathy and like put yourself in their shoes and just like truly, you know, try and comprehend what they're going through. And because, you know, typically people are probably, you know, you're the smartest person for yourself. Like, you know yourself better than anybody else, right? So I found that that just really changed my perspective on being able to help people even. And and it's just such a great thing. I was going to ask you a little bit about like ego and like the obsession with oneself. Like, you know, we started talking about you know, how people kind of get into this narrow, you know, this tunnel vision based upon stress or anxiety, or everything's happening to me. Why is this happening to me? You know, and then shifting their focus. Do you use like other techniques or tools that like any specific tools that really help people to shift that focus? Like, what other tools do you kind of use with your clients?
Yeah, I think you're right that a lot of that thinking comes out of a anxiety state. Mm-hmm. And so I think if that's what's going on for somebody, that they're really hyper anxious and aware, and that they kind of have that tunnel vision and that like one repeating story, and feeling almost like paranoid, then really working on anxiety management, and like that can be just a progressive muscle relaxation exercise, or focusing on their breath, or trying to feel grounded in a sensory way. We do that with some people when they're feeling like that, like just noticing their bodily sensations, just getting back into the moment can really help diffuse that anxiety state. Mm-hmm. And over time, if people can notice that that's something that they're doing, right? Like I'm noticing that I'm getting really uptight and I'm just thinking this, you know, this narrative that's not helpful to me, then allowing themselves to maybe take a break from the situation and come back to it. Like, okay, I'm just gonna, you know, especially if it's an interpersonal conflict or something, like I'm just gonna, you know, excuse myself and I'll be back. Right. Give it some time, because once we get really anxious, it could take our body a while to settle and let our whole brain get involved again. Right.
Right. And I, you know, is it safe to say like it takes some time, right? Many people probably think that, oh, I'm going to shift this overnight, or why don't I just think differently? Like, you know, maybe it's more about, focusing on the, you know, how much better we become, like, even if it's just a little bit better each time, we're a little bit quicker to become aware of it. Does that make sense? Is that something?
Oh yeah. I think that type of thing, like if you have a thinking style that's gone back decades or even just years, it's going to take a while to, have that kind of recede. Like in a way, one of the ways I describe it to people is like, that's your default mode of thinking. You've established this as your default mode. And so what we need to do is strengthen. It's almost like you have an imbalance. You've got this default mode is really strong about like, this is all about me and they don't like me or I'm not capable or whatever. But then you've got this other mode that maybe is an alternative to that, which is maybe a bit more curious, maybe a little bit more balanced. And so you almost have to like strengthen that alternative one to the point that it becomes stronger than what your current default is. So, I mean, that can take some time, right?
Right.
To do that.
And then the one last thing that kind of came to mind was kind of the why, what's the number one reason that you find people are hesitant to seek therapy? And then what would you tell them?
Yeah, that's a hard question. What's the reason they'd be hesitant?
Like you know, maybe it's just more of the bad, you know, like not the bad rap, but like, obviously that's a bad word.
Stigma.
Yeah, the bad stigma slash, you know, like, do I have to divulge all of my personal information to some stranger?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think there's that could be a reason for sure.
And like, how do you get to that point where it's like, you know, do you have to hit rock bottom, or is there something in your life that has to happen before you're just like, okay, like obviously it's maybe a hard one for you to answer, but what would you be able to tell people to maybe make them a little bit more comfortable to seek somebody if they're in some sort of detrimental state to themselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that like part of my work when I first see someone is to try to see what is their attitude towards, you know, meeting. Mm-hmm. And sometimes having to just tell them a little bit more about how the process works, right? Because to some people, it might seem like this black box, like, you know, they really don't know what it's like, right? And I think part of what's happening in our current culture is that there's a lot of demystification, right? Like there's Esther Perel's podcast where you can listen to couples therapy, I think there's a CBC one called In Person where you can listen to regular therapy. Like there's some shows, like even on The Sopranos, although that's not probably the best example, a little bit of a witch doctor, but like you can at least get a sense about like, oh, this is maybe how it might go. Right.
Right.
And then it doesn't seem so like intimidating or magical. Right.
Yeah.
And that's something I try to do with my clients. And I think like people appreciate sort of some transparency, like this is why we're doing it. This is how it's going. If you're not comfortable answering a question or going in a direction, like we definitely won't do that because it's not helpful if you feel uncomfortable, not right. too uncomfortable. It's okay to be a bit uncomfortable, but like, you know, and like definitely tell me, I always say the second time we meet, I always say, you know, how are you feeling after the first time? Mm-hmm. Is there anything we can shift about, you know, how you're working together and trying to find a good rhythm, like as a team kind of, and make it collaborative. So I think that that really helps people, especially if people come and they maybe have had a negative experience where they've maybe felt like maybe a little bit objectified or like, you know, pathologized or something, to just sort of look at it as, you know, this is a collaborative thing. Right.
Yeah, right. There's definitely parallels to that. And getting people into a gym. Like if I knew the reasons that people weren't going to a gym, I'd probably have a few more members. It's just like a black box. Yeah. They ultimately have to make the choice, right? At the end of the day. And, and on that note, we met at the gym. So I know that you're big into health and fitness. And I think there's a perception around people that deal with other people's issues, mental, whether it be mental health or physical, that we sort of have everything figured out. Obviously we don't. So, and especially in a pandemic when we're dealing with our own stuff and the whole world has shifted, it's tough to kind of prioritize, right? We have our mobility to work out, our mental health, our physical health, our cardio conditioning, our strength, our power, our, you know, our social skills. I want to know where your priorities are right now in terms of on that list. And what do your habits look like around that?
Yeah. I mean, it's really helped me being in this pandemic to have the toolkit that I have, you know, like sometimes I'll think the reason I became a psychologist is so that I could have years of therapy, you know, because it's always important to really know your own stuff to be able to help people. So I always saw that as part of like my training, but really it was very personally helpful. Right. So I think I'm pretty good at knowing like, what are my list of priorities of the things that I need? And then what are the sort of nice to have? So like for me, I would say the first thing I need is sleep. Yeah. I've always needed a lot of sleep and I'm not a great sleeper. So I really prioritize like having a good sleep routine, making sure I can get a good sleep, you know, never great for me. I'm just not a good sleeper, but like, I always prioritize getting to bed. Yeah. So I mean, even as we were up at a cottage recently and everyone's staying out late drinking at the dock and there's Gwen at like 9:30, quarter to 10. I'm like, good night. Yeah. And everyone just kind of laughs because they're like, oh, there she goes. Right.
That would be me too. You know. Yeah. Well, it's bed. Sun's getting down. It's getting dark. Yeah.
Me too.
So like, that's I funny. Would say that's number one. And then I think number two for sure is like some kind of movement. Like I just have always been a mover since I was little.
Yeah.
And so recognizing that that is a really big part of my mental health. So I do some kind of like a gym type of workout 4 times a week.
Awesome.
And whether that's in my garage during the lockdowns or at my gym when it's not locked down. And it sort of serves the purpose sometimes of also having social time. Like if I'm able to go to the gym, or sometimes I'll even do a Zoom workout with a friend if I'm stuck in the garage and we'll just do it at the same time as each other. So that's really good. And the days I don't go to the gym, I'm walking my dog or, you know, we have a pool, swimming, like whatever. Right.
Awesome.
And then third is just making sure my family's okay. Like I have kids that are 9 and 12 and have a husband, a dog. And so, you know, making sure everybody around me is doing okay and setting aside some time for each other. Like we usually have dinner together and do something together. So family's pretty important to me too.
For sure. Yeah. I love that. And this may have been intentional or maybe not, but I liked that wasn't your first answer. Cause I feel like that's the typical mom answer is everybody else has got to get take care of first.
Right.
But like you can't always pour from an empty cup and I'm not saying you're prioritizing yourself over them, but they can't benefit without you being at your best.
Yeah,
right.
You have to. Yeah.
And I think the thing that happens and, I don't know, Did you ever meet Adi Zuke? Super.
I didn't meet her. I know.
Adi Kazi was her name now. Right. So we got together back in the day. Yeah, WAG. So yeah. I remember her saying once that there's certain things in your life that are just going to happen. Like you're going to get them done and you don't have to prioritize them. Mm-hmm. So I feel like as a mom, I'm always going to take care of my kids. Like yeah. I'm always making sure that they're fed and that they have their play dates lined up and that they get to hockey. Like, and same with my husband, like they're always there. And same with mm-hmm. work. Like I didn't say yeah. work, but like work's always in my calendar. Right. So mm-hmm. I don't even like, it's almost like those obligations get done. Yeah. So the stuff you really have to actively prioritize, I find is taking care of myself.
For yeah. sure. Yeah. So. I love that. Cool. Just one thing before we wrap things up, Kyle, we're obviously on a podcast right now. So Kyle and I've been listening to a few of those. We've been listening to audiobooks and, I replaced a lot of my normal social time with just filling my brain with new info yeah. and stuff. Has there been a reference that stuck out for you in the pandemic, whether it's related to mental health or that's related, just something you found useful that's kind of stuck out to you over this, this last year and a half?
Yeah. So for I love podcasts too. So, one of them that I love that's kind of around parenting and kids is called Lusterklux. And it's really good about talking about kids' anxiety and parenting and how to deal with that. So that's a really good one. Awesome. It's run by a therapist. So she's got some nice, they're all like maybe half an hour episodes on different topics, like how to support teens in the pandemic or how to help your kids get back to school or, you know, how to manage your own anxiety as a parent so that your kids don't.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. So that's a good one. And then I also love Brené Brown's podcasts. She's got two. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
No.
One is called Dare to Lead, and it's all
I've heard of that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good one. And actually, there's one, maybe it was about 6 months ago, she interviewed a guy who writes about coaching.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about kind of what you were saying, Kyle, about just the power of listening and about delaying any advice giving.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. it was so good. Yeah. And then she has another one called Unlocking Us. So I really have enjoyed her podcasts this year. She gets great guests and I really enjoy it.
Cool. We'll put a link to those in the show notes. Well, thanks so much for joining us here today, Gwen. It was a great chat. Appreciate your time.
Welcome.
And
it was fun.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get to have you on again sometime.
I would love that. Yeah.
Sweet. Well, thanks so much for tuning in today, guys, at Healthspan Academy. And we'll see you next time.